What we're not talking about is that while climate change will first impact most dramatically the lives of people living in particular areas, water contamination, the way in which this carbon hydrocarbon industry destroys water, not only threatens our life, but our very ability to survive. So can you talk a little bit about the different ways in which our water supply is not only being compromised, but also being commodified, so that it's posing this double, multiple threat, in my opinion.
Well, absolutely, and I think a very apropos topic in that regard is the situation that's just emerging in Northeast British Columbia with Fort Nelson First Nation, which is a community I've spent a fair amount of time in over the last couple of years, making my film, co-directing with another Vancouver filmmaker named Fiona Rayer, that's called Fractured Land, and it looks at particularly at the impacts of the industrialization of Northeast BC and Northern Alberta and BC vis-a-vis fracking, natural gas hydraulic fracturing, and other related industrial impacts, and looking at that through the eyes of particularly one young First Nations man who's from that territory named Caleb Bain. And so that's a project I've been working on, and I've been in that community and out to the gas projects and have seen the scale of them. And now we find out that there are 20 different long-term water withdrawal licenses that this provincial government is considering approving in a very near future that entail the giving away of literally over the 40-year expected lifetime of these leases, trillions of liters of water over that time frame. And, one project in particular in Canada, that's on the table right now and that this community has risen to oppose, involves 3 billion liters a year of water to be pulled out of their sacred Fort Nelson River. It's the lifeblood of their territory, as they describe it. It's the way that they have historically transported themselves and conducted their trade throughout the region, visiting their neighboring communities. It's a key source of habitat for fish and wildlife. It's really, as they say, the lifeblood of their community. And the plan is to put a 20-meter concrete barrier into the river to suck out 3 billion liters a year to go towards fracking. And the community has risen in opposition to that. They're coming to Vancouver next week. Leaders of that community, chief and council and some elders, are coming down to share their story with people in Vancouver. And I encourage your listeners if you're on Facebook, you can find this event, but it's at Tuesday evening, November 13th, at the Mount Pleasant, I think it's the Mount Pleasant Community Center, and from 6:30 to 9:30, and people in Vancouver will have the unique opportunity to actually hear what's really going on up there from the source. And I think this is a really an important action for people to be aware of. And it really signals, if this thing goes through, I think it really does open the door. It sets a precedent, a terrible precedent, in terms of the commodification of large volumes, unimaginable volumes of water, to continue this unsustainable practice of hydraulic fracturing as it stands today with the amount of water that it involves. And it would definitely set a precedent for more of these long-term licenses going forward. So that's one particular area right now that's pretty scary, and I think British Columbians down here in Vancouver need to start paying attention to what's going on up there.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about fracking in general, because many people hear the word but are not always aware of the acute wound that this creates on the landscape and the kind of contamination that it entails.
Well, it's a relatively new combination of techniques that has enabled gas companies and oil companies using similar technology to access resources deep underground, encased in shale formations, And what it involves is drilling sometimes up to several kilometers underground into a shale formation and using horizontal drilling to drill sideways through that formation and then basically creating underground explosion with the use of high-pressure water. And this is where the water goes. It can be actually up to 10 million liters in one frack, which is one of these kind of explosions that's created by pressurizing that water, adding sand and a mysterious concoction of toxic chemicals that we have very little knowledge of what's going on there, and pumping that underground and cracking open those shale formations to release the gas. And so it poses a number of different concerns. One is heightened seismic activity in the same region that we're talking about here, where Fort Nelson First Nation resides, the Horn River Basin, which is one of the major shale gas production centers in British Columbia and one of the bigger in the world, in fact. And the Oil and Gas Commission came out with a report recently, 38 earthquakes in that region in a time span where comparatively a number of years ago there would have been none. And there's also the contamination of water, the taking of water out of the ecosystems. And you're taking that 3 billion liters of water from that one river every year. That water is now no longer available downstream to the rest of that ecosystem. So there are unknown consequences involved there. Very little, if any, monitoring. That river hasn't even been monitored by the government since 2004. So you have very little baseline knowledge of what the river's doing, what its current hydrological dynamics are, and what it would mean to take that amount of water out. And then to go ahead and contaminate with chemicals and pump it deep underground. And we don't know what's going to happen with all this cracking of the shale and where certain contaminated water is going to end up getting into. And so they've had issues in other places, northeast BC, and particularly in Pennsylvania, New York State, and another of the major shale gas plays in the Marcellus Shale, where people's water has been outright contaminated, where they can actually light it on fire because of the gases that have gotten and chemicals that have gotten into their water supply. So those are big issues. And then you have air pollution from the flaring of toxic gases and byproducts off of these well sites, and all the energy that's required to transport to process and transport this gas, and then this big plan to turn it into liquid and send it over to Asia. Again, enormously energy intensive, and that requires the building of a new dam, Site C dam, an 80-kilometer dam on the Peace River, the third dam in that system, if it goes ahead, and also the ability for these gas producers to burn their own gas to create power, the enormous amount of power that's required for these LNG operations. So when you take a step back and look at the whole footprint of this operation, this idea of fracking for natural gas in northeast BC, building new pipelines to carry it across the province, and then turning it into liquid and trying to access new markets in Asia, there's an enormous carbon footprint with that. There's enormous air pollution issues, seismic issues, water issues, and I really think that British Columbians have very little understanding of what's going on because this is largely up north and it's out of sight, out of mind, and that needs to change.
One of the, I think that sadly, one of the things that characterizes our reaction sometimes is the level of racism that goes into, you know, what we are blinded to, right? What we choose not to see. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see when you go to these communities, because while we are now paying attention to Enbridge Pipeline and the possible implications of having an oil spill and destroying the entire coast, we have not been paying attention to the terrible endemic poverty that has been imposed on these areas in northern BC, on the continual displacement of Indigenous people. What do you, how do you see the response? And I always ask, you know, what happens then? What happens when we stop the pipeline? You know, and everybody's glare and gaze on this place is gone. We leave those communities open to be yet utilized by gas companies or whatever other companies come, mm-hmm. whether it's a mine or, you know, and we're just not paying attention. How do you, I don't know, have you seen any response, any kind of discussion or at least acknowledgement of this point?
Well, what I see when I visit a community like Fort Nelson First Nation, for instance, is I see a community that is struggling with the economic benefits that gas development brings to their community and has historically. There are a lot of people in that community that have worked in the industry, and they've tried over the years to work with the province and the natural gas industry to provide those employment benefits to their community and also to create wealth for the rest of the province, and an enormous amount of wealth in terms of royalties and taxes and revenues for the provincial coffers have come out of that region. And they've done their best, I think, to try to reconcile their commitment to protecting their land and their core cultural values and their environment with responsible resource development. I think what's happening now is, number one, the industry, because of all the new supply that's been brought on around North America from this relatively new fracking technique, it has flooded the market in excess supply, and that has driven the price of gas down to historic lows. What used to be $8 or $10 a decade ago is now $2 or $3 a unit. And so that has actually resulted in a ramping down, a significant cutback of activity in the area, which would be reversed if these new markets in Asia through the LNG plan were opened up. Then that would put renewed pressure on the rapid development of these resources in the territory, which would carry considerable environmental consequences, again, as it has in the past. But I think what they're realizing now is that they can survive and find ways of feeding their families without being 100% reliant on this industry. And I think they're realizing that they probably have, over the years, bent over backwards to accommodate the industry, that they haven't been properly consulted by government over the enormous impacts on their territory from this industry, and that needs to change now. And if there is going to be a way forward where they can work together in a mutually beneficial way, then it has to be done responsibly. And so what they're calling on here is not for the shutting down of the fracking shale gas industry, but for a halting of the issuing of these long-term water licenses until First Nations and the public in British Columbia are properly consulted in the development of a responsible, clear, sustainable water management plan that takes into account all their key concerns, like protecting habitat for fish and wildlife, like making sure that these rivers and withdrawals are properly monitored and that the companies are monitored so that we know that they're sticking to the rules. So that, you know, proper baseline studies to know what's there right now before you go plowing in there, so you aren't able to measure how things are changing and adjust, industrial activity accordingly. And so that's what they're asking for, and I think it's pretty reasonable. These aren't communities in Northeast BC that are necessarily suffering from the same level of poverty that we see in some other First Nations communities in BC, because there has been a lot of wealth come out of their territories, and they've been able to share in some of those benefits over the years. I think that it's been a drop in the bucket compared to what it probably should be, and these communities should have better resources at the disposal of their members, hospital facilities, community recreation facilities, all these sorts of things, commensurate with the amount of money that's coming out of their territory. But there's got to be, in their view going forward, there's got to be some way to kind of balance these things out and to do it better going forward. And I think that's what they're calling for. And I definitely see a connection, a historical connection, to protecting the water. I mean, this is something that's come out as a message very clearly from their elders and their leadership, is that water is kind of like the line in the sand that they have to draw. When it comes to now these water licenses, this signals a change in things that they can't just go along with. and they have to raise their voices because that is sacred to them. They understand how integral that is to those ecosystems and to their ability to live off the land and hunt moose and do all the things that have sustained their people for years and that they would like to continue to do in balance with modern resource development. I think that's basically the situation up there right now.